Mob History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 54, the 1747 impressment riots. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to discuss a draft riot that took place in Boston. Today, when we talk about draft riots, the image that comes to mind is probably long-haired college students who were resisting the Selective Service system during the Vietnam era. There were countless protests against the war during that time, and at least one that degenerated into a riot on the Northeastern University campus in January of 1970. History-minded listeners might think of the draft riot in the North End in July of 1863, when the militia ended up firing a cannon into a crowd of mostly Irish-American men, women, and children who were protesting conscription into the Union Army. Today, however, we're talking about a draft riot that took place well over a century before the Civil War. In 1747, a British commodore began kidnapping sailors and working men in Boston, and the people of the city wouldn't stand for it. 3 days of violence followed, pitting the working class of Boston against the colonial government and Royal Navy. But before we talk about the impressment riots of 1747, remember that we're experimenting with a new format for the show, so it's time to take a look at this week's historical site and event.
The first historic site we're going to highlight in this new segment is Roxbury's Shirley Eustace House. If you caught our anniversary episode a couple of weeks ago, you know that Jake and I volunteered there as docents last summer. And besides that personal connection, there are a number of connections to this week's episode, as will become clear as the show unfolds. The Shirley Eustace House is not, as it might sound, named after a person named Shirley Eustace. Instead, it's named for two different governors of Massachusetts who lived at the house during very different periods in our history, William Shirley and William Eustace. William Shirley was born in 1694 in East Sussex, England. He inherited funds from his grandfather in 1717, which he used to purchase a clerkship in London. He then married Frances Baker, with whom he had 8 children by 1731. And although his inheritance had been substantial, he led an expensive lifestyle and suffered significant losses in the Depression of 1721. This prompted him to seek an appointment in the North American colonies. His family was connected by marriage to the Duke of Newcastle, who became an important patron and sponsor of Shirley's advancement. And armed with letters of introduction from Newcastle and others, but no appointment, Shirley arrived in Boston in 1731.
Shirley was not well received by Massachusetts Governor Jonathan Belcher, who refused him patronage positions that became available. After some political maneuvering with Belcher's opponents, coupled with the influence of the Duke of Newcastle, Shirley replaced Belcher as royal governor in 1741. Shirley's high point in office was his successful 1745 expedition to capture Louisbourg from the French. Coffers full from war profits, he purchased 33 acres in Roxbury the following year, and constructed the residence that would become known as Shirley Place. Built in the Georgian style of the day, Shirley Place was a summer home, a complement to his official residence in Boston, the Province House. Shirley left Boston for a time, serving as the governor in the Bahamas, and then returned to live his final days with his daughter and son-in-law. By this time, Boston was unrecognizable, as evidenced by his confusion as to where the devil this brace of Adamses came from. He died in 1771, just as things in Boston were getting interesting. Shirley's daughter Elizabeth fled Boston during the exodus of the Tories, and the abandoned house served as a barracks and field hospital for Asa Whitcomb's Massachusetts 6th Foot Regiment. The troops left Shirley Place on March 5, 1776, relieving troops on Dorchester Heights, who were attending Henry Knox's newly installed cannons. The house was then seized by the Massachusetts Committee on Absentee Estates, or the Committee to Seize and Sell Tory Properties, and was sold to John Reed in 1782. Reed did a classic flip, buying it at an auction rate, fixing it up, and selling it for a hefty profit to the widow of a plantation owner who fled the uprising in San Domingue. The house changed hands twice more, and was substantially renovated before being purchased by William Eustace in 1819. William Eustace was a doctor and a protege of Joseph Warren. Congressman, Secretary of War under Madison, Minister to the Kingdom of Holland, and the first Democratic-Republican governor of Massachusetts. He was also BFFs with Aaron Burr. The two regularly exchanged letters, recommending potential romantic partners to each other, and bonding over their taste for well-educated women. Eustace, at Burr's request, helped place Mariah Reynolds' child into a school in Boston. This is especially juicy gossip for all you Hamilton fans out there. The Eustace is decorated with French and English furniture brought back from Europe, while Carolyn had a greenhouse constructed under the South Piazza to cultivate, among other things, her award-winning pears. Most notably during this time, Lafayette spent the night with the Eustaces during his 1824 tour of America.
After William's death, it's believed that Carolyn did some Victorian-era renovations and had central heat installed. And after her death, the family auctioned off the home's contents immediately, and in 1883, the house was converted into a tenement. The sinking verandas were removed, and the house gradually fell into disrepair and was once again abandoned in 1911. In 1913, the home was purchased by the Society for the Preservation of New England Antiquities, the predecessor to Historic New England. But the question remained, what to do with Shirley Place? In 1965, it was suggested that the house could become the Massachusetts Governor's Mansion. But Governor Furcolo wasn't really interested in a fixer-upper in Roxbury. One caretaker took in stray cats and dogs until the whole herd was evicted. In 1968, the house was sold to the state for $1 to qualify for a HUD grant and state funds to stabilize the property. In 1979, the Shirley Eustace House Association acquired the property, beginning the decades of work necessary to open as a historic site. Today, it is one of just four remaining royal governor's residences in America. And coincidentally, the property also holds Isabella Stewart Gardner's carriage house. The Shirley Eustace House is located on Shirley Street in Roxbury, just off Dudley Street, and not far from Dudley Square. It's unfortunately the off-season right now, but if you visit the house in May, which we highly recommend, you will see, among other things, Eustace's china set from the Society of Cincinnati, a bed slept in by Lafayette, and two of the finest crafted banisters I have ever seen. And if you visit next fall, you might be able to help yourself to a variety of fruits from the orchard. There is street parking at the site, and it's a short walk from the 15 bus. Check out this week's show notes for a link to the Shirley Eustace House website, where you can get directions and hours.
Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was a historian and a member of the John F. Kennedy administration. He won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1945 for a book on the Age of Jackson, so he was already a highly regarded author and historian by the time he joined JFK's campaign in 1960. He worked as a speechwriter and an advisor during the campaign, then he was appointed as a special advisor to the president after Kennedy was elected. He would later work on the Robert F. Kennedy campaign, as well as the McGovern campaign. Schlesinger is perhaps best known for his second Pulitzer winner titled A Thousand Days. It was a careful recounting of the Kennedy administration, and is widely credited with establishing JFK's presidential legacy. On Monday, November 20th, the Massachusetts Historical Society is hosting an author talk by Richard Aldiss. He just published a new biography called Schlesinger, the Imperial Historian. Aldiss will be presenting in conjunction with Frederick Longueval of Harvard and discussing Schlesinger's legacy, and by extension, that of JFK. The session begins at 6 p.m. Registration is required and costs $10. See the show notes this week for a link to register. And now let's turn to this week's main topic.
The trouble started on the morning of November 17th, 1747. The evening before, officers from the British Navy, accompanied by the sheriff of Suffolk County, had swept through the streets of Boston. They chased down anyone they could catch who looked like a sailor. A ship's carpenter named Jonathan Tarbox was captured and later testified about the experience. Along with two or three persons, all inhabitants of Boston, going in a boat to Mystic, having their tools with them to caulk a vessel there, they were chased by three boats belonging to Commodore Knowles' squadron. After the British boats caught up, Tarbox tried to explain that they were Bostonians and not sailors. The British officer in charge, in a very rough manner, answered that they did not care for that, for the Commodore had ordered them to impress all they could meet without distraction. Another group stopped a merchant ship called the Mercury that was sailing out of the harbor. Of the crew of 19 sailors, the British threw 16 into chains. The remaining three sailors were not able to fully control the undermanned vessel, and it ended up suffering serious damage before they could bring it back into port. Its scheduled cruise had to be canceled while the ship's master made repairs and searched for a replacement crew.
These were the press gangs of the Royal Navy, feared from Boston to Barbados to Bengal. The life of a sailor in the 18th century was not usually a happy one, and the Navy could provide few incentives to convince men to enlist. To fill out their crews, officers relied on coercion. The practice was called impressment, which basically meant that they were allowed to kidnap any British subject and make him a sailor. The practice of impressment predated the Magna Carta, so it had been in place for well over 550 years by the time our story takes place. Historian Jack Tager describes who could be impressed into the Royal Navy. Impressment was initially applied only to seamen, but over time, anyone on shipboard or in seaports was ripe for the press gang. Englishmen anywhere on the globe were subject, but there were exceptions. All landsmen except harvesters, gentlemen, apprentices, ship's officers and bosuns, and various skilled artisans. This meant that it was largely the urban lower orders, sailors, simple craftspersons, and the wide variety of common laborers of the seaports, who were the targets of the press gang. In one night in Boston, the press gangs captured 46 men. Boston was the closest North American port to London, and it had a long history with impressment. So as word of the press gang spread quickly through the town on the morning of the 17th, people were ready to take action. First, about 300 members of Boston's working class armed themselves with rusty swords, cat sticks, pitch mops, and clubs, and began rampaging through the streets. They soon encountered a lieutenant from the HMS Lark and took him captive, along with a deputy sheriff. With these hostages, the mob made its way toward the home of the royal governor, where they believed more officers, perhaps even the Commodore himself, were taking refuge.
Commodore Charles Knowles was the officer in charge of the British fleet that now lay at anchor in Nantasket Roads on Boston Harbor. He was about 40 years old and had been at sea with the Navy since he was about 14. He had a reputation as an intelligent officer with a long history of victories against Spanish fleets and forts. Most recently, Charles Knowles had been appointed as the royal governor of the British fortress at Louisbourg. After 2 years in that position, he was appointed as commander-in-chief of the naval station in Jamaica. However, as he sailed south in October 1747, his fleet ran into a strong storm and suffered a lot of damage. In his first letter to the Admiralty, Knowles wrote that his ships had met with the most violent storm of wind I ever yet saw, in which the Canterbury was obliged to throw overboard all her sea guns to save the ship, and the Warwick lost all her masts. I shall make what haste I can to get the ships filled again. When they stumbled into Boston Harbor for repairs and a refit, sailors began deserting wholesale. Louisbourg still loomed large in the collective imagination of Boston. In 1745, Governor William Shirley had organized a force of over 4,000 colonial militiamen to attack the French stronghold on Cape Breton Island, then called Isle Royale. About 1,000 came from Connecticut and New Hampshire, while Massachusetts Bay supplied the rest of the army. That spring, they sailed about 90 transport ships, reinforced by about a half a dozen ships of war from the Royal Navy, and laid siege to the strongest French fortification in North America. Against all odds, they were successful. After a month and a half of fighting, the French garrison at Louisbourg surrendered. The British authorities had been so skeptical of the militia's chances that they made no arrangements to occupy the fort in case of victory. With no British regulars on the way, it fell to the militia to garrison the fort. The colonials, however, had signed up for a siege and did not expect to serve as an occupying army when the siege was over. And once it was clear that the militia was going to have to stay at Louisbourg over the winter, Governor Shirley traveled to the fortress to address them and convince them to stay strong until spring. While he was gone, a press gang arrived in Boston. The HMS Wager anchored in Boston Harbor in November of 1745, and the captain applied for a warrant to impress sailors. This was the established legal process for impressment. The royal governor would grant a warrant to the officers of the Royal Navy to impress a crew. The warrant allowed the civilian government to apply restrictions and guidelines to the actions of the press gang.
In Governor Shirley's absence, the warrant was issued by Lieutenant Governor Spencer Phipps. His order specified that residents of Massachusetts would be exempt from the press, and that only crews of incoming, not outgoing, ships should be pressed. And above all, the warrant excluded any of the men who had been in the late expedition to Louisbourg. To make sure that the warrant was followed, he charged Deputy Sheriff Nathaniel Hasey to use a number of discreet men, inhabitants of this province, and no others. This order was meant to ensure that the press gangs would know who was an inhabitant of the town and who was not, preventing any violation of the warrant. For whatever reason, Hasey ignored this charge. The entire press gang was made up of British officers with no locals to guide them. They broke into several houses where Boston-based sailors were sleeping, brandishing their swords, and they carried away any man who was too slow to react. In the North End, they kicked in the door of the quarters where three sailors were staying. They were crewmen on the Resolution, a coasting vessel that carried goods up and down the New England coast. Not only that, but all three were veterans of the difficult campaign at Louisbourg. When the press gang finally got into the upstairs room where the three men were barricaded, the candles were put out and, readers, our language does not afford words bad enough for the villains, perfidious and execrable wretches fell upon the poor unarmed men with their cutlasses and stabbed and hacked two of them in so terrible and inhuman manner that one of them died the next day and the other the evening following. But the third had the good fortune to escape their rage by hiding himself in a closet. Moments later, the captain of the Resolution showed up with a group of friends, all armed. Most of the press gang fled, but a bosun and a ship's boy were caught. They would be prosecuted for the murder of the two sailors and sentenced to death, but the crown issued a stay of execution and let the accused escape from the province. This wasn't Boston's first experience with impressment, and it wouldn't be our last. As early as 1693, the governor of Massachusetts had a Royal Navy captain arrested and sent to London in chains after he attempted to impress Boston residents without a warrant. In 1702, Lieutenant Governor Povey went as far as ordering the guns at Castle William, today's Castle Island, to open fire on the HMS Swift to keep her from leaving the harbor with illegally impressed sailors on board.
That isn't to say that it was impossible to impress sailors in the town of Boston. Throughout the 18th century, British captains who were willing to work with the civilian government of the province and follow the rules were able to fill out their crews with unwitting and unwilling men captured in our town. For example, Governor Belcher issued a warrant to the captain of the Astrea in June of 1740, saying that His Excellency issue a warrant to Edward Winslow Esquire, Sheriff of the County of Suffolk, to impress 20 seamen not being inhabitants of this province, nor belonging to any outward-bound vessel, fishing vessel, or coaster, for the recruit of His Majesty's ship, the Astrea. While perfectly legal, an impressment like that would still shake Boston. Sailors on ships coming into port would suddenly find themselves in His Majesty's service, whether they liked it or not. Despite assurances by the governor, the working class, especially dock workers, would live in constant fear while press gangs were about. And there was a sort of trickle-up effect. Because they risked losing their crews to the Navy if they docked in Boston, civilian captains would route their vessels to other ports. Without shipping, the merchant class of Boston suffered. In 1741, a legislative committee attempted to ease the hardship of coasters, fishermen, wood carriers, and others being interrupted and hindered from bringing supplies as heretofore, of which there seems to be danger also for the future, unless some remedy be provided for the prevention thereof. New York and Philadelphia were further from both the British Isles and the seat of the war against France that was being fought in coastal Canada. Without impressment, Their economies benefited, while Boston's languished.
When Commodore Knowles arrived in Boston Harbor in the fall of 1747, he may have had a reputation as an accomplished naval officer, but he also had a reputation for ignoring local laws and customs when it came time to impress sailors into his crew. In June of 1743, Knowles had sparked a riot in the British Caribbean colony of Antigua when he ordered press gangs to target a local privateer vessel. He did not have a warrant from the colonial governor, and the crew was based locally in Antigua, both of which should have exempted them. In addition, privateers were considered a valuable defense for merchant vessels against Spanish and French raiders. The following October, he nearly sparked a riot in Barbados, when he again targeted privateers for impressment. This time, however, he left the island for another posting before the press gangs could do their work. By the time Knowles and his fleet arrived in Boston Harbor in 1747, there were a lot more exemptions from impressment than just privateers. In 1708, the British Parliament had passed an Act for the Encouragement of Trade to America, which was commonly known as the Sixth of Anne Act, because it was passed in the sixth year of the reign of Queen Anne. This law attempted to appease the colonists in North America who opposed impressment by banning press gangs from the entire Western Hemisphere. After the War of the Spanish Succession ended in 1713, the Crown argued that the act had been only temporary. Colonies in the Caribbean resigned themselves to the resumption of impressment, but the mainland colonies in North America held fast to their exemption. It was only in the early 1740s that impressment once more became the law of the land in North America, including in Boston. After decades without the threat, its reintroduction was not popular. Impressment required a warrant from the governor, and pretty much everybody but incoming seamen was exempted. Skilled laborers, outgoing sailors, and anyone who resided in Massachusetts was supposed to be safe from the press gang. Commodore Knowles ignored all that.
In a single day, his press gangs kidnapped 46 men, including ship's carpenters and other skilled laborers, outgoing sailors, and local residents. And he did it without a warrant from the governor. As the sun rose on November 17th, 1747, a mob of some 300 people were marching in the street, armed with cutlasses, boat hooks, and improvised weapons. They seized some unlucky officers of Knowles' fleet and made their way toward Governor Shirley's house, where they found more officers were being sheltered. None of the accounts we looked at made it clear exactly what house they went to, but it was probably the province house. As you heard earlier in the episode, his summer residence, Shirley Place, was in Roxbury. It was the royal governor's prerogative to live in the province house when he was in Boston. Province House was located at the corner of today's Province and Bromfield streets. Conveniently, it was just steps from both the common and the courthouse where the state government met. Unfortunately, it was also a central location for an angry mob to gather. Shirley would later write that when he heard the mob was coming to his doorstep, "I immediately sent orders to the colonel of the regiment to raise the militia of the town and suppress the mob by force, and if need was, to fire upon them with ball, which were scarcely delivered to him when they appeared before my gates." Unfortunately for Governor Shirley, only a few officers of the militia turned out. By all accounts, most of the militia members had, by that time, joined the rioting crowds in demanding the return of the impressed Massachusetts men. Fearing that the mob would soon break down the doors and carry them away, another source says, "The officers of the navy within carried themselves with carbines and placing themselves at the head of the staircase seemed resolved to proceed to the last extremity."
Meanwhile, Governor Shirley stepped outside to reason with the rioters, accompanied by Thomas Hutchinson. In 3 decades, Hutchinson would be the last royal governor of Massachusetts, but in 1747 he was both a Boston selectman and the Speaker of the Massachusetts House. During a tense confrontation in the dooryard, Shirley put himself physically between the leaders of the mob and their hostages, allowing the naval officers to get into his house to safety. Then Hutchinson, who was a very popular politician at the time, tried to calm the crowd and convince them not to force their way into the house. At that moment, a sheriff's deputy appeared and tried to order the crowd to disperse. Sheriffs and their deputies were frequent participants in press gangs, so the mob's temper was inflamed. They assaulted and beat the deputy right there in Shirley's dooryard. Then, Drake's History and Antiquities relates, the mob took him, and in a triumphant manner bore him to the front of the townhouse and there fixed him in the stocks. This they looked upon as a kind of victory, and it seemed to cool their rage, and disposed them to separate and go to dinner. With the morning's excitement over, the town turned quiet for the rest of the day. During the lull, Governor Shirley assembled the House of Representatives at the courthouse, or the townhouse, which of course is the building we now know as the Old State House. The legislators and the governor discussed strategies for dispersing the mob, such as issuing a proclamation or offering rewards for informants. However, as long as the militia refused to turn out, there was little the governor could do to enforce his will.
That evening, the mob took to the streets again. Hutchinson would later estimate its size at several thousand, which is remarkable when you consider that the entire population of Boston at that time consisted of about 16,000 people. In a letter to the Board of Trade, Shirley recalled, "The mob now increased and joined by some inhabitants came to the courthouse just after candlelight, armed as in the morning, assaulted the council chamber by throwing stones and brickbats in at the windows, and having broke all the windows of the lower floor, where a few of the militia offices were assembled, forcibly entered into it, and obliged most of the officers to retire up into the council chamber, where the mob was expected soon to follow them, but prevented by some of the few officers below who behaved better." Mm-hmm. Imagine the scene. Governor Shirley, the governor's council, and a few members of the House of Representatives were barricaded on the upper level of the courthouse. On the first floor, the mob had smashed out all the windows and forced their way inside, waving swords, clubs, and everything short of actual pitchforks and tiki torches. The narrow stairway leading upstairs formed a bottleneck, preventing the mass of rioters from forcing their way upstairs, and it was blocked by a handful of brave and loyal militia officers. The people of Boston could elect their town selectmen and their representatives to the great and general court, but they had no vote for parliament and they had no say in the workings of the Royal Navy. If government requires the consent of the governed, the mob was now making it clear that the people did not consent to the manner in which the press gang had operated. You have to imagine that the negotiations that followed were tense, to say the least.
First, two popular members of the House went out onto the balcony of the upper chamber, the same balcony from which the Declaration of Independence was first read to the people of Boston in 1776. They tried to calm the crowd with little success. Then Hutchinson urged Shirley to address the crowd. He went onto the narrow stairway and gave a brief address to the crowd, then spoke with the leaders of the group. Shirley's account said that the crowd demanded that he get the impressed inhabitants and some of the outward-bound seamen discharged, which, against my inclinations, and to prevent their charging any bad consequences which might happen from this tumult upon my refusal, I yielded. Hutchinson recalled that the governor, in a well-judged speech, expressed his great disapprobation of the impress, and promised his utmost endeavors to obtain the discharge of every one of the inhabitants, and at the same time gently reproved the irregular proceedings. After some additional back and forth, the mob agreed to disperse. They said that they would return to the courthouse the next morning to verify that the governor had kept his word and the impressed Massachusetts men had been released. Rather than quietly returning home, most of the mob started toward a nearby shipyard where a 20-gun ship was being built for the Navy. On the way, Shirley recounts that they were diverted from their purpose against the king's ship by the sudden coming to shore of a barge, which they took to belong to one of Mr. Knowles's squadron, seized and carried it in procession through the town, with an intention to burn it in my courtyard. Drake recalls that this was done with as much seeming ease as if it had been in water. Shirley then continues, I ordered a party of officers to go out and oppose their entrance at my outward gate, which about 10 of them immediately did, and upon the appearance of the mobs preparing to force that gate open, cocked and presented their muskets at him through an open palisade fence. This appears to have had the desired effect, as the crowd desisted and immediately altered their scheme to that of burning the barge in an out part of the common. The crowd seemed satisfied with their success, though it later turned out that the barge did not belong to the Knowles fleet, but to a Scottish merchant. Throughout the night, parties from the mob broke into houses, taverns, and a naval hospital, searching for additional officers and taking them hostage.
With the morning light on November 18th came the realization that the militia had dispersed into the crowds. Governor Shirley was left without an effective force to impose order, or even to protect his household and the naval officers he was harboring. In the face of an increasingly hostile population, Shirley did not think it consistent with the honor of His Majesty's government to remain longer in the midst of it. The governor fled to Castle William, the fortress on Castle Island in the harbor, where he would be under the protection of the British regulars. Once safely behind the fort's walls, he sent a letter to Knowles aboard the Canterbury, asking him to release the impressed men in return for the hostages. Jack Tager recounts the Commodore's reaction. The hot-headed Knowles decided to punish the rioters. Men present on the deck of Knowles' flagship, HMS Canterbury, gave depositions later affirming his intentions to rake the town with shells. One mariner, James Bernard Jr., heard Knowles call the gunnery officer to prepare 24 guns with shot, saying, "By God, I'll now see if the king's government is not as good as a mob." Another witness, Nathaniel Parker, saw Knowles read a letter informing him of Shirley's flight, which in great passion he tore to pieces and with a severe stomp ordered the guns to get ready to be loaded. A carpenter from Boston was on board at that moment making repairs and said, "Oh, how will that do? Sir, the righteous will suffer, and the wicked. How will you find out the rebels?" He answered, "The North End people were the rebels." I told him, "I should suffer then, for I lived there." He replied, "No, no, I'll take care of that. I will punish the guilty." I told him he must be very curious in throwing his shot then. A flurry of messages then passed back and forth between Shirley and Knowles, and Shirley was able to at least talk the Commodore out of shelling the town. You probably knew this already, as the town of Boston still exists. Knowles would not release the impressed men until his officers, who were being held hostage, were released. The mob was reluctant to give up their bargaining chip, but also wary of the Commodore's threat to burn the town, and a threat from Shirley that he would bring in the wider provincial militia to restore order. Finally, on the evening of the 19th, they released their prisoners, and the Commodore released all of the impressed men who were Massachusetts residents. Shirley's letters reveal that the militia finally assembled that night, saying, "A strong military watch was kept in the town, and the riot suppressed." Hutchinson recounted that the next day there was an uncommon appearance of the militia of the town of Boston. Many persons taking their muskets, who never carried one upon any other occasion, and the governor was conducted to his house with as great a parade as when he first assumed the government.
On November 30th, Commodore Knowles and his fleet weighed anchor and set sail for the West Indies, as Hutchinson put it, to the joy of the rest of the town. You'd think that such an incident would be a blemish on the record of an officer, but Knowles was promoted to admiral upon arriving in Jamaica. He would have a prominent role in the Battle of Havana in 1748 and be appointed as Royal Governor of Jamaica in 1752. After retiring from the Royal Navy in 1770, he was invited to the court of Russia's Catherine the Great, where he served as a naval advisor as she modernized her fleet. It wouldn't be the last experience of impressment in Massachusetts. Right up to the Revolutionary period, the people of Massachusetts continued to resent the practice of naval impressment and to resist it when they could. In 1768, for example, a press warrant was issued for the port of Boston, but it could not be enforced because a mob met the press gang boat at the docks and refused to let it land. The very next year, four Boston men resisted a press gang with such violence that they killed the officer in charge. They were prosecuted for piracy and murder, but acquitted on grounds of justifiable homicide. Even 65 years after the Knowles riot, well after America had won her independence, British impressment of American sailors was one of the major causes of the War of 1812.
At first, we thought it was somewhat curious that so many histories of the impressment riots would rely so heavily on accounts from Thomas Hutchinson and William Shirley. However, The very next entry for 1747 in Drake's History and Antiquities might shed some light on the topic. On the 9th of December occurred a fire in the townhouse which destroyed that building, together with many records and papers of great importance. A news report the next week would say, "Last Wednesday morning, the town was exceedingly surprised by a most terrible fire, which broke out in the courthouse, whereby that spacious and beautiful building, except the bare walls, was entirely destroyed."
After smoldering overnight, a fast-moving fire broke out before the people came to either manage the engines or save the province records, books, papers, plans, pictures, or anything else in the chambers or apartments, to the inestimable loss of the province. But through the mercy of God, the county records under the western staircase below, and part of the province records under the eastern staircase below, as also copies of the minutes of the council from the beginning to 1737, being at the secretary's dwelling house, were happily saved. The brick courthouse had replaced the earlier wooden townhouse, which itself burned in 1711. The 1747 fire gutted the courthouse to the bare brick walls. When the new interior was finished, today's familiar old state house was created. To learn more about the impressment riots, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/054. We'll have a copy of an article placing the Knowles riots within the wider Atlantic world, a link to Jack Tager's book, Boston Riots, 3 Centuries of Social Violence, and a link to the relevant chapter in Drake's History and Antiquities of Boston. We'll also have a historical cartoon depicting a British press gang that was published in 1770. And of course, we'll have links to more information about this week's historic site and upcoming event.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show. And please be in touch this week and let us know if you enjoyed our new segment featuring a historic site and upcoming event. If you missed This Week in Boston History, you can follow us on Twitter and get each day as it comes.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with the story of the Boy Fiend, Boston's youngest serial killer.